cabinets in the kitchen. "This is the kind of shit I like," he told his partner. "They don't make this stuff anymore. Tight." The woman walked in circles, trying to think of where to begin. She told one of the deputies that she knew she was being foreclosed, but that she didn't know when they were coming. Her attorney had told her that it could be a day, 5 days, a week, 3 weeks. She decided to ride it out. She and her 3 children had been in the house for 5 years. The year before, she had been talked into refinancing with a subprime loan. Her payments kept going up, jumping from $920 to $1,250 a month, and her hours at Pottawatomie Casino were cut back after her maternity leave. Hispanic and African-American neighborhoods had been targeted by the subprime lending industry. Renters were lured into buying bad mortgages, and homeowners were encouraged to refinance under riskier terms. Then it all came crashing down. Between 2007 and 2010, the average white family experienced an 11% reduction in wealth, but the average black family lost 31% of its wealth. The average Hispanic family lost 44%. As the woman rushed away to frantically call people to come over and help, the movers exchanged tired glances and whispered curses. They hated doing a full house toward the end of the day, but that was precisely what they had on their hands. A mover started in on a girl's bedroom, painted pink with a sign on the door announcing, "The Princess sleeps here." Another took on the disheveled office, packing resumes for dummies into a box with a chalkboard counting down the remaining days of school. The oldest child, a 7th grade boy, tried to help by taking out the trash. His younger sister, the princess, held her 2-year-old sister's hand on the porch. Upstairs, the movers were trying not to step on the toddler's toys, which, when kicked, would protest with beeping sounds and flashing lights. As the move went on, the woman slowed down. At first, she had borne down in the emergency with focus and energy, almost running through the house with one hand grabbing something and the other holding up the phone. Now she was wandering through the halls aimlessly, almost drunkenly. Her face had that look. The movers and the deputies knew it well. It was the look of someone realizing that her family would be homeless in a matter of hours. It was something like denial giving way to the surrealism of the scene. The speed and violence of it all. Sheriffs leaning against your wall, hands resting on holsters. All these strangers, these sweating men, piling your things outside, drinking water from your sink, poured into your cups, using your bathroom. It was the look of being undone by a wave of questions. What do I need for tonight, for this week? Who should I call? Where's the medication? Where will we go? It was the face of a mother who climbs out of the cellar to find the tornado has leveled the house. Every Sunday morning, Lorraine stood on the seam that separated the linoleum in the kitchen from the thin green carpet in the living room, looking out the front window for Mr. Dabbs' truck. Mr. Dabbs, a member of her church, would drive into the trailer park, remove his hat, and knock softly on Lorraine's door. When they got to the Southside Church of Christ, a modest brick building with a high-pitched roof roughly a mile and a half northwest of the trailer park, Mr. Dabbs would hold the door open. Lorraine would step gracefully in, walking past her photograph on the wall displaying members' portraits. In the sanctuary, a humble space, unadorned, sunlight from large back windows streamed onto the pews. The ceiling bowed up, resembling a great, overturned boat. Lorraine would take her seat in the second-to-last pew on the left, next to Susan and Lane. This was where her family had always sat. Susan usually ignored Lorraine and pretended to read the bulletin as Pastor Darrell, a large man with red hair and a beard, strolled the aisle, shaking hands and slapping backs. This being a Church of Christ, there was no organ or piano, no acoustic guitar. When the congregation stood to sing, "I Stand in Awe," or "O Worship the King," voices rose up a cappella. Lorraine prayed with her palms resting gently on her thighs. When it was time to take the offering, she would let the basket pass. Susan would drop something in. Recently, Pastor Darrell had been preaching on the cost of discipleship. He would pace the front of the church, Bible in one hand, PowerPoint clicker in the other, and repeat Jesus's more impossible injunctions. "Anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. I think one of the biggest shames of Christianity is people that halfway follow Jesus, Pastor Darrell observed one Sunday. A partial commitment is a dangerous way to live. You got neighbors around you that need help. You got people that need helping and that need loving, and as Christians, you can be demonstrating that love to them. During Pastor Darrell's sermons, Lorraine would sit still with near-perfect posture, rapt from beginning to end. She loved going to church and had since she was a child. When Lorraine called Pastor Darrell to ask if the church could lend her money so that she might avoid eviction, he said he'd have to think about it. The last time Lorraine called, she had said she'd been robbed at gunpoint. Pastor Darrell reached into the church's coffers and gave her a few $100s for the rent. Lorraine had been robbed, but not by a stranger with a gun. Susan and Lane's coquette daughter had broken into her trailer when no one was home. Susan phoned Pastor Darrell to report Lorraine's lie. Pastor Darrell felt torn. On the one hand, he thought it was the job of the church, not the government, to care for the poor and hungry. That, to him, was pure Christianity. When it came to Lorraine, though, Pastor Darrell believed a lot of hardship was self-inflicted. She made some stupid choices, spending her money foolishly. Making her go without for a while may be the best thing for her, so that she can be reminded, hey, when I make foolish choices, there are consequences. It was easy to go on about helping the poor. Helping a poor person with a name, a face, a history, and many needs, a person whose mistakes and lapses of judgment you have recorded, that was a more trying matter. Pastor Darrell called Susan and told her that Lorraine had asked for money to stay her eviction. Susan replied by saying that she didn't think the church should give her sister anything. Pastor Darrell called Lorraine back and told her that he wouldn't be helping this time. In the trailer park office, Lenny was bent over his desk, filling in his rent rolls, when a woman named Brittany Baker walked in. She was in her late 20s, wearing cheap sunglasses. Brittany pulled her mail out of her box and then turned to Lenny. I'm gonna pay it, you know, she said.
Good,
Lenny said.
I'm going to pay this week. Don't give me a 5-day. I mean, Tobin knows my situation.
And with that, Brittany left. Lenny shook his head and looked back down at his rent rolls, which showed that Brittany owed a balance of $2,156. The relationship between non-payment of rent and eviction was anything but straightforward. Every month in the trailer park, tenants who owed more than $1,000 were not evicted, while some who owed far less were. If you asked Tobin why, he would say,
"You're loyal to the people who are loyal to you. Some people we work with. Some people I wouldn't give a single penny."
Lenny put it like this.
Depends on what their excuses are.
With Lorraine, Lenny and Tobin felt she was chronically behind.
Every month it's the same thing, Lenny said. Ain't got no money.
But every month it was the same thing with Brittany Baker as well. And she would not be evicted. Landlords and building managers weighed several factors when considering whether to evict a tenant. Tenants who could convince landlords that they had money coming down the pike, in the form of a tax refund, say, could avoid eviction. Tenants who fell too far behind without a clear way of getting caught up often could not. But evictions were not simply the consequence of tenants' misbehavior or landlords' financial accounting. Landlords showed considerable discretion over whether to move forward with an eviction, extending leniency to some and withdrawing it from others. How a tenant responded to an eviction notice could make the difference. Women tended not to negotiate their eviction, like men did, and they were more likely to avoid landlords when they fell behind. These responses did not serve them well. Landlords and building managers generally hated it when tenants avoided them. Ducking and dodging, they called it. When tenants hid from Lenny, it made him angry.
Fuck you,
he once yelled after a tenant peeked through the blinds and refused to answer her door.
You pissed me off now. You're out in 5 days.
Like many women in her situation, Lorraine was ducking and dodging Tobin and Lenny. She never once told them, or even Office Susie, how she was planning on getting caught up. She never asked for a little more time. Meanwhile, Lorraine's neighbor, biker Jerry Warren,
confronted Tobin and Lenny immediately, balling up his eviction notice and threatening to wreck Lenny's face. Belligerent as it was, Jerry's confrontational response aligned with Tobin's blunt and brusque way. Property management was a profession dominated by men and by a gruff, masculine way of doing business. That put men like Jerry at an advantage. Not only did Jerry confront Tobin immediately after being served, but he later offered to pick up litter and repair some trailers if Tobin cleared his debt. Jerry had done some work for Tobin in the past, painting trailer hitches and winterizing pipes. Having proved himself a reliable hand, he had established a working-off-the-rent option, should money run thin. Lorraine rang up social services and begged family members. Jerry went straight to the man who had initiated the eviction. And it worked. Tobin later dismissed his eviction. Lorraine's plan could work only if a local nonprofit organization, her family, or her church came through. Men often avoided eviction by laying concrete, patching roofs, or painting rooms for landlords. But women almost never approached their landlord with a similar offer. Some women, already taxed by child care, welfare requirements, or work obligations, could not spare the time. But many others simply did not conceive of working off the rent as a possibility. When women did approach their landlords with such an offer, it sometimes involved trading sex for rent. The power to dictate who could stay and who must go. The power to expel or forgive. It was an old power, and it was not without caprice. Tobin's decision to work with tenants could be arbitrary, his generosity unevenly dispensed, but at least you had a chance. In fact, one reason Lorraine risked eviction and paid her gas bill was because other tenants had told her, speaking from experience, "Tobin's a nice guy, just give him a little, and he'll work with you." This was why, when Tobin complied with Alderman Witkowski's demand to hire an outside management company, the trailer park began to worry. New management would institute a new system, a cleaner, more professional, and fairer way of running the park. In other words, things were about to get much worse. One day, a man showed up outside Lenny's office and drilled a sign into the cinder blocks that announced, "Professionally managed by Beak Management." When an older resident saw the sign, she stepped into the office and began sobbing. "They evicted me from my last place," she told Lenny. "They are so harsh." "Yeah, I hear they are ruthless," Lenny said. "They put a whole lot of people on the streets. You know, if you can't work with people a little bit." "What about you, Lenny?" the woman asked, after collecting herself. "They're looking for a way to get rid of me. I can see that." Lenny gestured toward the sign. "But it's not happening. You gotta have somebody around here who knows the park," he told the woman. And himself. When everyone else had said no, Reuben had come through. Lorraine's baby brother, who had found a way to lift himself into the middle class, who worked full-time for PPG Industries, had reluctantly agreed to pay Tobin. He brought the money to the trailer park himself, but Tobin refused to accept it, telling Lorraine that he didn't want the money. Tobin walked away, leaving Lorraine and Reuben standing, stunned, outside of the office. Reuben put his money back in his pocket and walked slowly with Lorraine back to her trailer. A few hours later, Lorraine answered a knock at her door and found two sheriff deputies standing on her small porch. Behind them, the Eagle moving trucks were pulling into the trailer park. It was a tight pinch for the drivers, maneuvering through the narrow entrance, minding the unleashed dogs and children, and backing up to the designated spot. But Eagle had been in Tobin's park plenty of times. It was the last move of the day, and the crew was sore and eager to get home. The movers were hoping for a junk-in, but Lorraine asked that her things be taken to storage. Reuben loaded her television and computer in his car, and then left to pick up his kids. The movers began filling boxes with Lorraine's things, the white utensils in the kitchen, a Christmas gift for her grandson, a necklace Glenn had given her. A deputy taped an orange sign to her door. "Notice, you have been evicted from this property by virtue of a court order served by the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office. Your presence on this property without the express permission of the landlord will be considered trespassing and may result in your arrest.
Statute 943.14. Lorraine asked for more time to gather some belongings. The deputy said no. Then she asked if she could retrieve some items from the truck. A mover said no, citing the company's insurance policy. Lorraine stood outside, silently looking on. The movers carried out her chair, her washing machine, her refrigerator, stove, dining table. Next came the boxes with who knows what inside, perhaps winter jackets or shoes or shampoo. The neighbors began to gather. Some grabbed beers and positioned lawn chairs as if watching a NASCAR race. It didn't take long. Lorraine was cleaned out in less than an hour. She watched the truck lurch away. Her things were headed to Eagle's storage warehouse, a dimly lit expanse with clear light bulbs strung from a ceiling supported by large wood pillars. Inside, there were hundreds upon hundreds of piles, each representing an eviction or foreclosure. The piles were stacked to eye level and individually encircled in shrink wrap like so many silken-wound insects on a spider's web. Up close, the contents were visible through the taut, clear wrapping. Scratched-up furniture, lamps, bathroom scales, and everywhere, children's things. Rocking horses, strollers, baby swings, bouncy seats. The Britton brothers thought of the warehouse as a giant stomach digesting the city. They charged $25 per pallet per month. The average evicted family's possessions took up 4 pallets, or 400 cubic feet. Lorraine would have to find a way to pay her storage bill. If she fell 90 days behind, Eagle would get rid of her pile to make room for a new one. This was the fate of roughly 70% of lots confiscated in evictions or foreclosures. Years before, the Britton brothers had approached Goodwill but were rebuffed. There was simply no way Goodwill could handle that kind of volume. The brothers searched elsewhere. They reached out to metal scrappers. They found someone who would buy the clothing by the bale, turning it into rags. They partnered with people who would rummage through the piles, looking for things to sell. They organized public sales twice a month, each involving 10 to 40 lots, but most of the stuff ended up in the dump. With the sheriff out of sight, Lorraine ignored the orange sign and broke back into her trailer. The big items were gone, but the movers had left behind clothes, blankets, and miscellaneous smaller things. Lorraine reached down and picked up her steamer. There was only one option, Lorraine thought. Take what was left to Beaker's trailer. He was in the hospital. He couldn't say no. Lorraine recruited a pair of boys to help, and the three of them made several trips between the two trailers, piling whatever they could carry in Beaker's living room. When the work was done, Lorraine gave each boy $5 and sat alone in Beaker's trailer, swatting away fruit flies. She swallowed pain pills, including 200 milligrams of Lyrica. In silence, she let the painkillers work. Once they had, she looked around at the clutter, the foulness, and the pile of things the movers had considered junk. Lorraine let out a muffled scream and began punching the couch over and over and over again. 10. Hypes for Hire. Wright Street was covered in snow. An early December storm had arrived and was predicted to drop 10 inches. It was that wet, slushy snow, the heavy kind you shovel in small doses so as to avoid throwing out your back. Lamar looked out the window as the snow continued to fall, drinking instant coffee and putting off the job he had to do. Once he and the boys had finished painting Patrice's old unit, Lamar called Sharina, who came straight over to inspect the work. After a swift march through the unit, she shook her head and offered an evaluation. I tried to work with you, and you disrespected me with this motherfucking shitty-ass job. What I did is worth way more than $260, Lamar had yelled back. I'm crawling around on my knees painting for you, and you gonna do me like this? Sharina stormed off. A few hours later, Lamar dialed Sharina's number. He begged her to let him finish the job, to cover the spots the boys had missed. Please, he said. I don't like being in nobody's pocket. Sharina decided to give him another chance. It was his best hope of keeping his home. Lamar finished his coffee and strapped on his legs. Grabbing his cane, he opened the door and stepped onto the porch, grimacing at the snow and clutching the stair rail to keep from falling. Patrice's son, Mikey, was outside, trying to shovel the sidewalk. He paused when he saw Lamar struggle on the porch steps, unsure of whether to offer his hand. He didn't, and Lamar managed fine. He even gave Mikey's shovel a few pushes. When Lamar said he was heading upstairs, Mikey asked if he could help.
"Come on, son," Lamar replied.
Inside, Mikey looked around the apartment he and his family had been evicted from.
"Why y'all didn't make it to school today?"
Lamar asked. It was a Tuesday.
"I guess I fell asleep,"
Mikey answered. He was in the fourth grade.
"Ah, boy, Michael, you don't get no education like that, son."
Mikey put his head down.
"We had art today," he said.
"Don't you know you can get rich off of art? Don't you know that you can have a career being an artist? An architecter?"
Mikey smiled a broad smile, and Lamar began sweeping a paintbrush through the pantry. To reach the lower sections, he unclipped his prosthetic legs and crawled on the floor. Mikey helped in any way he could. He passed Lamar rags and rollers with such quick eagerness, you would think he was competing for the job. When Lamar got stuck on the floor, Mikey would fetch his cane.
"Where's your mama and them at, man?"
Lamar asked.
"My mama?
She went to get her quest card from Dace,"
Mikey started, speaking of Patrice's food stamps and boyfriend.
"And he took her cards and she ain't have nothing to eat. So, and her cards, Michael, okay,"
Lamar interrupted gently.
"You could have just said she was gone. Don't tell nobody your mama's business, man. You know I'm a friend, but I didn't really want to know."
Mikey nodded slowly, pretending to understand. Lamar scooted along the floor and, quietly resolved, lifted his brush. As the morning wore on, he began sweating and breathing heavily. He grunted and prayed for strength.
"Jesus, get me through the day."
"It's ridiculous, Lamar,"
Mikey said, trying to console.
"No, it's people get out of you what they can get out of you. That's what it is, Michael."
When the job was complete, Lamar reaffixed his legs and headed back to his apartment. From there, he called Sharina to tell her he had finished painting. Promising nothing, she said that she would come by later to have a look. Then she asked Lamar to mop the floor, too. Buck stopped by later in the afternoon. Noticing the paint on Lamar's skin and clothes, he asked,
"I thought we was done up there, man."
"Man, she made me go up there and take care of the pantry. People just don't be satisfied."
"That's money, Pops."
Buck smiled, glad that Lamar and his boys would be able to stay. Lamar sighed and massaged below his knees the way someone rubs an old, familiar injury.
"They ain't gonna pay, man," he said.
"They gotta pay. Man, they can get some hypes to do it for way less than that."
Lamar's labor was cheap, but he knew there were better deals to be had. When the plumbing broke, the roof leaked, or rooms needed painting, savvy inner-city landlords did not phone plumbers, roofers, or painters. They relied on two desperate and on-hand labor pools, tenants themselves, and jobless men. New landlords would speak of knowing a good plumber. Experienced landlords would say they had a guy. Lamar knew that Sharina had people and doubted that she would let him stay. He did the painting anyway, having no better option. Buck frowned and stared at the snow.
"Nah, Pops,"
he said, disbelieving.
"Hypes!"
Lamar shouted.
"Hypes done messed up everything. It's hard to even sell a bus pass at the right price. I had to argue with her to get that job for $260. She got guys that'll do it for $100. The whole thing, drywall and all."
The next Tuesday, Lamar woke up to a warm house. He had kept his stove burners on overnight to fend off winter's chill, a common trick used by those who inhabited the north side's drafty duplexes with old furnaces. A week had passed without any word from Sharina. Most days, he had instant coffee and a cigarette for breakfast. But he had allowed Luke and Eddie to stay home from school, so he began frying eggs and boiling grits. The smell of bacon pulled the boys out of bed, and soon Buck stopped by, as if he had smelled Lamar's cooking from his house down the street. A soft tap was heard at the back door, and one of the boys opened it. It was Kamala, the new upstairs neighbor, the third in 5 months.
If you spotted her a block away, you might think she was in 7th or 8th grade. Kamala was petite, with skin blacker than purple, as the saying went. A white tank top clung to her thin frame. She wore no makeup or nail polish. Her only flourish was a locket that hung from a thin gold chain. Her eyes were heavy. Her whole spirit was heavy. She asked Lamar for a cigarette.
"Here you go, baby,"
Lamar said, handing her one. He was happy to see her. Kamala thanked him and turned to leave.
"Let me go check on these kids, make sure they're not tearing up my house."
Kamala had three daughters, ages 3, 2, and 8 months.
"Well, come on down here and let them tear up my house. You don't play cards, do you?"
Kamala gave Lamar a small smile and started up the steps, only to be met by her 2-year-old. Lamar rolled his wheelchair up to the girl.
"Let me see who my little goddaughter's gonna be. Hey, how you doing?"
The child said something, but her words were woolly and half-formed. She had to repeat herself a few times before Lamar could understand that she was saying, "Tummy hurt."
"You hungry?" Lamar asked. "We need to put some weight on her. You cook yesterday?"
It was a pure question, untraced by incrimination.
"Yeah, but all's I got is a microwave up there,"
Kamala answered softly. Like many inner-city landlords, Sharina and Quentin tried to limit the number of appliances in their units. If you didn't include a stove or refrigerator, you didn't have to fix it when it broke.
"Huh. Okay."
Lamar spun his chair and pushed himself into the pantry. When he rolled out, there was an electric hot plate on his lap. A few days earlier, after he had first met Kamala, Lamar had said that he ain't getting too friendly with her and her family.
"It ain't gonna be no thing like, 'I need a cup of sugar,'" he had said. "We ain't doing that. I keep to myself. It works out better."
But there he was, giving Kamala something worth quite a bit more than a cup of sugar.
"This was my mom's," Lamar said. "It cooks its ass off."
"Ain't gonna start no fire?"
Kamala asked.
"It ain't start no fire."
"Okay, I'll take care of it. I thank you for it."
"You're welcome, honey. Y'all come down for dinner tonight."
Kamala took the hot plate and her daughter up the stairs. The cards and blunts came out after breakfast. CJ, Patrice's young brother, came over and watched the game. He wasn't offered a hit and didn't ask for one. Luke's girlfriend showed up and the two shut the bedroom door behind them. The morning passed slowly as milky smoke and the weed's sweaty pungency filled the house. Just as Lamar and the boys were finishing a blunt, its pleasant effects setting in, someone knocked loudly and confidently on the front door. It sounded like a landlord's knock, or a sheriff's. 4 or 5 hard knuckle taps in quick succession. Everyone stopped talking and looked at one another. After a moment had passed, Buck called out,
"Who is it?"
"It's Colin from the church."
"Shit," Lamar said, at once relieved and annoyed. The boys muffled their laughter. Eddie threw open a window and everyone began frantically waving their hands through the air, pushing the smoke out, laughing harder.
"Okay, okay,"
Lamar whispered, giving the sign to calm down and act normal. Then he had Eddie open the door. If Colin smelled weed, he didn't say anything. He was in his late 20s and white, with ungelled hair, good posture, and a wedding band. In one hand, he carried a Bible and a workbook with the title, By Grace Alone. In the other, cookies. After everyone had found a seat in the living room, everyone except Luke and his girl, Colin opened his Bible and dove in. He covered the basics.
"For God so loved the world,"
John 3:16.
"God made him who had no sin to be sin,"
2 Corinthians 5:21. The boys sat quietly, trying to hold on to their high. Then Colin asked them to read some passages. They smiled at one another and read with their fingers tracing the words. Lamar leaned into the scripture verses, nodding meditatively and finishing them by memory.
"For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God," Lamar said. "I've been thinking like this, right?"
Buck started, reclining on a couch pillow.
"Then say it."
Lamar encouraged with closed eyes.
I don't know why people don't believe in God. You believe in the devil too, right?
Lamar asked.
I know there is one, but I don't want to know him,
Buck responded.
And earth is hell,
Lamar added.
Well, not quite hell,
Colin corrected. Lamar opened his eyes and looked at the boy preacher. A silence hung in the air, and in that silence, adolescent moans and squeaks could be heard coming from Luke's room. Hearing this, the boys locked their eyes on the floor and focused on suppressing the laughter pushing its way up. After leading a closing prayer and handing Lamar a checklist of things he could pick up from the church, clothes, blankets, Colin left, and the house fell out laughing. When Luke joined the group in the kitchen, the boys erupted again.
We heard you getting it in,
Buck teased, folding sideways from laughing.
The preacher here, you stupid dude.
Lamar shook his head and dealt the cards. At the end of the month, Quentin parked outside of Arlene's apartment on 13th Street and honked the horn. He wasn't there for Arlene this time. He was there for Chris, Trisha's new boyfriend.
Man, I'm hungover as shit, Chris said as he got into the truck. My lady got me a six-pack of Heineken and a motherfucking fifth of Amsterdam.
Quentin put the truck in drive. His hair was parted in the middle and tied twice in the back, forming a pair of small afro puffs. Chris, who was in his late 30s, wore a large winter coat and covered his bald head with a knit cap. When Chris moved in with Trisha, after being released from prison, he called Quentin and said he was looking for work. Quentin was Chris's only source of income. The Suburban pulled up next to an apartment, and Chris jumped out to get Tiny, another worker. A few minutes later, he came back alone.
Man, dude said he don't feel like coming.
Quentin shrugged.
Dude playing games, man.
When Quentin called Sharina to tell her that Tiny didn't want to work, she replied, we'll just slide someone else into his spot. Workers could be found and replaced just like that. There was Sharina's brother, who had a crack habit, or Quentin's uncle, Vern, a gummy-faced alcoholic happy to log hours for beer money. Tenants often asked for work. Even Ricky One-Leg had been calling. Plus, Sharina had on call a crew of hypes, jackleg crackheads, she called them, willing to work for peanuts. In a pinch, Quentin sometimes recruited men right off the street. It wasn't hard to do with so many men in the inner city out of work. Sharina and Quentin provided tools, materials, and transportation. They paid workers by the task or the day. The amounts typically ranged from $6 to $10 an hour, depending on the job. These people, Sharina once said, no matter how much money it is, it's money, and they will work, and they will work for low prices. Reported high rates of joblessness among black men with little education obscured the fact that many of these men did regularly work, if not in the formal labor market. Some, hustling in the underground economy, plied the illicit trades, but the biggest drug kingpin in the city would have been envious of the massive cash-paid labor force urban landlords had at their disposal. Quentin dropped Chris off at a newly acquired property he and Sharina were planning on renting to a woman with a housing voucher. Quentin told Chris to steady the staircase railing and fix a door in anticipation of the Section 8 home inspection.
You know how rent assistance is, Quentin told Chris. Everything got to be perfect. They be coming with some ugly lists. All right, boy,
Quentin said, as he and Chris exchanged the Vice Lord's handshake. In high school, Quentin used to run with the Vice Lords, a street gang that originated in Chicago. He was never very active in the gang, and the two times he had been shot were not gang-related. Quentin took his first bullet when he was 19. He and his friends were in a heated confrontation with a group of guys when suddenly a van raced up, and he heard the pop-pop of a 9mm. Quentin was shot in the leg. The second time came a year later, during a mugging. That time, the bullet lodged in his shoulder blade. The shootings left Quentin on super alert. A doctor later would diagnose him with stomach ulcers. Over the years, he had learned to relax. When tenants threatened him, he tried to let it slide. But every so often, something would happen, and Quentin would put on his black hoodie and black jeans
and Sharina would shoot him a dirty look at the door but stay quiet because she had learned she couldn't say anything when it got to that point. And Quentin would climb in the Suburban and call his guys and go deal with something. The last time the Black Hoodie came out, a tenant had intentionally and severely damaged one of his properties out of spite. Around sunset, after running between Home Depot and Lowe's, where he was on a first-name basis with the cashiers, after transporting this worker and delivering that tool, Quentin popped his head into Patrice's old unit. His Uncle Vern had spent the last 2 days there, gliding polyurethane over the hardwoods and covering up the white paint Lamar and his boys had dripped on the brown trim. Quentin was done negotiating with Lamar, even after he painted the pantry. He left Sharina to deal with him. One thing was certain. If they were paying Uncle Vern, they weren't paying Lamar. He would have to come up with another plan, and fast. Uncle Vern's greasy hair rebelled from all sides of his Baltimore Ravens cap. His pants and flannel shirt were covered in brown paint. His eyes were cloudy and bloodshot. Crumpled aluminum carcasses of drained tall boys, Steel Reserve 211, crack in a can, littered the stairwell.
"I need my juice," Uncle Vern told Quentin.
Quentin looked around. The work was shoddy, but done.
"It's good enough for a tenant to move in," he assessed. "Huh, this ain't Brookfield," Uncle Vern laughed, referencing the predominantly white and affluent suburb. "You know," Quentin said, "it doesn't even matter, 'cause all they gonna do is tear shit up. Sliding furniture, sliding tables, kids, dogs with claws. We don't need to take no time trying to do no expensive type stuff to it, 'cause they just gonna mess it up."
Quentin reached for his wallet.
"Boy, you racking up. That's gonna be like 70 by the time you done." "70? Nah, 'cause this room $30.
Uncle Vern motioned to the large living room.
"No, this room is 20. Remember we talked about this yesterday?" "No, I was charging $20 and you was charging 10 a room."
Uncle Vern laughed nervously.
"Well then, I'll just have Tiny do this then."
This was Quentin and Sharina's normal response when workers asked for more pay. They simply reminded them of their expendability. Uncle Vern backed down.
"Okay, okay."
Quentin counted out the cash and gave his uncle a ride to the liquor store. From their downstairs unit, the Hingstons had been listening to Quentin and Uncle Vern the whole time. When the men left, Patrice and Natasha snuck upstairs to have a look. Seeing the freshly painted walls and floors, the women sucked their teeth. The new tenant, or at least her payee, Belinda, seemed to know what Patrice did not. Your leverage as a renter was strongest before you moved in.
"It looks so pretty," said Natasha. "I'm just like mad."
"Unreal," Patrice said.
"It's like a dream house up here, and you in the rat hole."
Natasha laughed. Patrice didn't join her. Thinking of Sharina, she said, "She wouldn't survive a day in our house." 11. The Hood is Good. As her plane touched down, Sharina looked out the window and sighed. That morning, she and Quentin had been in Jamaica. Milwaukee looked chilly and damp, like a left-out dish rag. Sharina switched her phone back on and saw that she had 40 voice messages. Jamaica had been amazing. Sharina and Quentin took long walks on warm white beaches, chartered a glass-bottom boat, and zipped around the Caribbean on jet skis. Quentin bought a walking stick and had it engraved. Sharina got her hair done in two thick braids that met in the back. They had stayed for 8 days. Sharina and Quentin always planned their vacations so that they were back before the first of the month, when their days went long with eviction notices to pass out, new moves to manage, and rents to collect. Because most of their tenants didn't have bank accounts, collecting rent was a face-to-face affair. A few of Sharina's voice messages were from Tabitha, a social worker who made weekly visits to the Hingstons' house. When Sharina returned her call, Tabitha cited the plumbing situation at 18th and Wright and tried to advocate for some repairs. Not long after Doreen paid a plumber herself, the pipes backed up again. Sharina was not hearing it. "I can't believe that you are on my phone complaining to me about the sink being stopped up when they're the ones doing it, Sharina said. They pull hinges off doors, have clothes piled to the ceiling. The whiff of shit hits you in the face when you open the door. I cannot believe that your organization is allowing her to have a house that looks like that. Then Tabitha made a mistake, telling Sharina that Doreen was looking for another place. Sharina got off the phone and headed for the courthouse. If Doreen was withholding rent so the family could move, Sharina would call her bluff. Sharina paid the fee and scheduled a court date, giving Doreen an open eviction on CCAP. Now, moving would be much harder. If the Hingstons were going to go, Sharina decided, they would go on her terms. After Quentin delivered the pink papers, Doreen called Sharina to clear things up. We do need a bigger place, she said. Natasha fitting to have a baby, and we can't be stacked up in here like this. But I didn't mean immediately. I can't see myself trying to move in the middle of the winter. She'd be delivering sometime in May. Maybe then we can try to find something bigger. Sharina told Doreen she wasn't calling off the eviction. I got you, Doreen said. I got your money. But Sharina refused to accept it, citing the stress the family was putting on her unit. What if the state come up in there? She asked. Then they shut my place down, and we all gonna be in trouble. I can't have all those people living in my apartment like that. Too much wear and tear. All Doreen could do was pray that Sharina would change her mind before they met in eviction court. On the first of the month, Sharina and Quentin flirted and giggled as they drove from one property to the next. They had brought some of Jamaica back with them. Their skin was sun-kissed and their spirits were buoyed. They caught Ricky one leg outside, waiting for UPS to deliver a computer for his daughter. A computer? Sharina asked when Quentin climbed back in the Suburban. Yeah, Quentin smiled. See? He got money for a new computer, but not for the rent. That's okay, 'cause I got him. The rent's going up. Sharina paused for effect. Inflation! Laughter filled the Suburban as it pulled onto the street. Quentin's seat was leaned so far back he was resting more on his hip than his rump. Air fresheners swayed from his rearview mirror, and a large speaker in the back thumped bass whenever one of them was not on the phone, which was almost never. As night fell, Quentin took a call from a rooming house tenant, touching his Bluetooth earpiece. When the call ended, he said, "They money burning a hole in their pockets. You know they got habits." Quentin parked in front of the rooming house and went through a small ritual. He tucked his chains into his shirt, removed his pinky ring, and slid a sweatband over his thick bracelet. He had learned that some people think you're out to take their rent money to buy, you know, fancy things. A tenant had recently pointed to Quentin's bling and said, "You just want to collect my rent to live your own life." When he relayed this story to Sharina, she shrugged and said, "How else are we supposed to do it?" To live, she meant. The rooming house tenants had smoked something but had not yet run through the rent money. The place was filled with music, laughter, and that carefreeness the benefits of the first of the month bring, and the bills of the fifth of the month shoo away. The only tenant who appeared sober was an old man who had just moved in. He sat on his bed, shirt buttoned to the top. "Coming at night, huh?" he asked with a Mississippi drawl. "When do you want to pay your rent?" Quentin replied. "I'm ready. Always owing something." Up walked another tenant with glazed-over eyes. "Hey, nigga," he addressed Quentin, holding an unlit cigarette and leaning on the wall for support. I be at the bar, man. They be fucking with me, man." "Straight up?" Quentin asked, sliding the old man's money in his pocket and heading for the door. Back in the Suburban, Quentin presented Sharina with a wad of cash. She had to admit it. "Those crackheads pay the rent." They laughed. It was almost 9 p.m. when Sharina asked Quentin to drive to the home of a new prospective tenant. LaDonna invited Sharina in and introduced her 8-year-old son, Nathaniel. A working single mother, LaDonna was eager to move. "They shoot in broad daylight right in the middle of the block," she said. "We got a hiding place upstairs, and I'm getting tired of running up there." "They need to get the National Guard up in here," Sharina replied. "Something. I'm leaving." Then LaDonna handed Sharina $500. I want that house, and I'm not playing with you. So Friday, I'll give you another 100, and then the following Friday, another 100, and then the following week, another 175.
Sharina climbed back in the Suburban, which Quentin had kept running.
She's crazy about that house.
Then she went on. There are so many rent assistance people that have been calling me, you wouldn't believe it.
Ah, they've been calling me too, Quentin said.
For single families?
For anything.
LaDonna had a housing voucher. Sharina and Quentin didn't accept rent assistance in most of their properties because they didn't want to deal with the program's picky inspectors.
Rent assistance is a pain in the ass, Sharina said.
Voucher holders made up a small share of the market anyway, only 6% of renter households in the city, and were not worth the headache. The SSI people, on the other hand, now that is an untapped market, Sharina thought. But Sharina had recently purchased the house that LaDonna coveted, a 2-story gem, and she was pretty sure it would pass inspection. If it did, the payout could be significant. With a housing voucher, LaDonna would pay a small portion of the rent, 30% of her income, and taxpayers would pick up the rest. Sharina's rent would be virtually guaranteed. It would also be above market rate. For each metropolitan area, the Department of Housing and Urban Development sets a fair market rent, FMR, the most a landlord could charge a family in possession of a federal housing voucher. FMRs were calculated at the municipal level, which often included near and outlying suburbs. This meant that both distressed and exclusive neighborhoods were thrown into the equation. New York City's FMR calculation included Soho and the South Bronx. Chicago's included the Gold Coast and the South Side Ghetto. This was by design, so that a family could take their voucher and find housing in safe and prosperous areas in the city or its surrounding suburbs. But the program did not bring about large gains in racial or economic integration. Voucher holders more or less stayed put, upgrading to slightly nicer trailer parks or moving to quieter ghetto streets. It could, however, bring about large gains for landlords. Because rents were higher in the suburbs than in the inner city, the FMR exceeded market rent in disadvantaged neighborhoods. When voucher holders lived in those neighborhoods, landlords could charge them more than what the apartment would fetch on the private market. In 2009, the year LaDonna was hoping to move into Sharina's new property, the FMR for a 4-bedroom unit in Milwaukee County was $1,089. But the average 4-bedroom apartment in the city rented for much less, $665. When landlords were allowed to charge more, they did. Although Sharina didn't think the housing authority would approve the maximum amount, she was planning on charging LaDonna $775 a month, $100 more than the average rent for similar units, but still well below the FMR limit. LaDonna didn't mind. With a voucher, what she paid was a function of her income, not Sharina's rent. Her rental expense wasn't affected. The taxpayer's bill was. In Milwaukee, renters with housing vouchers were charged an average of $55 more each month compared to unassisted renters who lived in similar apartments in similar neighborhoods. Overcharging voucher holders cost taxpayers an additional $3.6 million each year in Milwaukee alone, the equivalent of supplying 588 more needy families with housing assistance. The idea of a rent certificate program was first proposed in the 1930s, not by some Washington bureaucrat or tenants' union representative, but by the National Association of Real Estate Boards. That group would later change its name to the National Association of Realtors and become the largest trade association for real estate agents, with more than 1 million members. A rent certificate program would be superior to public housing, they argued. Landlords and realtors saw government-built and managed buildings offered at cut-rate rents as a direct threat to their legitimacy and bottom line. At first, federal policymakers disagreed, and at mid-century decided to fund the construction of massive public housing complexes. But real estate interests kept lobbying for vouchers and were joined by numerous other groups of various political persuasions, including civil rights activists who thought vouchers would advance racial integration. Eventually, after America's public housing experiment was defunded and declared a failure, in that order, they would have their day.
As housing projects were demolished, the voucher program grew into the nation's largest housing subsidy program for low-income families. In policy circles, vouchers were known as a public-private partnership. In real estate circles, they were known as a win. Sharina bought the house she was going to rent to LaDonna a few weeks before flying to Jamaica. It was a large, late colonial-style home with a round turret and generous porch. Someone had recently painted it black and white. The roof was new, and so was the water heater, and so were the wood-framed windows. The front door opened into a living room with a vaulted ceiling and an intricate mosaic fireplace. There was one bedroom downstairs and three upstairs, which you reached by mounting a long, bending staircase. Thick carpet lined the upstairs bedrooms, two of which, judging from the paint, used to belong to children. The house was in such fine shape that the inspector told Sharina that he wanted to move in himself. The black and white house was on a quiet street in the inner city. Sharina judged the block stable because it's been vacant one whole year and not one fucking window is broken. And because the people lock it down. If you come over to the house, they out on their porch like, can I help you? They have their eyes on the street. Sharina's new pride and joy had cost her $16,900. She paid cash for it. She had purchased properties for less, $8,000, $5,000, but none were as stunning as this one. A few days before LaDonna was scheduled to move in, Sharina stopped by the house to check on the repairs. She walked through its rooms and smiled in disbelief. When the feeling welled up, she did a little dance. Since the foreclosure crisis, Sharina had been buying properties throughout the North Side at a rate of about one a month. In some cities, as many as one in two foreclosures was renter-occupied. The crisis had provided landlords an almost magical opportunity. This moment right now, Sharina reflected, it's going to create a lot of millionaires. You know, if you have money right now, you can profit from other people's failures. I'm catching the properties. I'm catching them. If you have money right now, that was the rub. The mortgage sector had shriveled up during the financial downturn. In 2007 alone, the number of loan organizations fell by 25%. Fearing insolvency, banks still in operation turned into miserly lenders, instituting stricter lending standards, requiring pristine credit, and demanding large down payments. If you want a loan this year, the Washington Post reported, you're going to have to pay more, thousands of dollars more in some cases. Landlords, naturally, were more succinct. Banks went from stupid to stupid, their assessment went, meaning that banks had spun an about-face, going from being reckless to overly cautious. That was too bad for real estate investors not flush with cash, because there were deals to be had. Gorgeous, unprecedented deals. Rents had soared during the run-up to the crisis, in large part because the housing boom and aggressive property flipping left landlords with bloated mortgage payments and higher tax bills. After the crash, property values fell, and with them, mortgage and tax bills. But rents remained high. In January 2009, the free foreclosure list distributed to Milwaukee real estate investors displayed around 1,400 properties, each listing for $30,000 or more below assessed value. The properties were ordered from least to most expensive, beginning with a two-bedroom unit listed at $2,750. 10 properties down, there was a three-bedroom going for $8,900. 10 more down, a four-bedroom for $11,900. If Sharina couldn't buy a property outright, she financed the purchase in a number of ways. She took out conventional or even adjustable rate mortgages. When she saw a deal but didn't have the down payment, Sharina sought out OPM, other people's money, or hard money. Shorthand for rich white guys from Brookfield or Shorewood who offered high-interest loans that didn't require any money down, but instead placed a lien on the property. Sharina put it this way. Usually the banks say, we want 20% down. Here's this private money guy saying, hey, I'll give it to you, but your interest rate is going to be 12%, and you have to give me this money back within 6 months or a year. If Sharina defaulted, she would lose the house to the private lender. The same thing that made homeownership a bad investment in poor black neighborhoods, depressed property values, made landlording there a potentially lucrative one. Property values for similar homes were double or triple in white middle-class sections of the city. But rents in those neighborhoods were not. A landlord might have been able to fetch $750 for a two-bedroom unit in the suburb of Wauwatosa and only $550 for a similar unit in Milwaukee's poverty-stricken 53206 zip code. But the Wauwatosa property would have come with a much higher mortgage payment and tax bill, not to mention higher standards for the condition of the unit. When it came to return on investment, it was hard to beat owning property in the inner city. "You buy on the north side because they cash flow nicely," said one landlord with 114 central city units. "In Brookfield, I lost money, but if you do low income, you get a steady monthly income. You don't buy properties for their appreciative value. You're not in it for the future, but for now." Sharina looked for properties that would give her a cash flow of at least $500 a month after expenses. The house LaDonna would rent easily cleared that bar. Sharina owned it free and clear. The repairs only set her back $1,500, and the monthly rent would be $775. If the house inspired Sharina to dance, it was because she knew she would recoup her total investment in about 2 years. She was used to this rate of return. Shortly after buying the black and white house, she bought a duplex off Keefe Avenue for $8,500, repairing it for $3,000. It would take only 8 months to make that money back. After that, it just cashed out. Sharina estimated her net worth at around $2 million, but equity was icing on the cake. The real money was made in rents. Every month, Sharina collected roughly $20,000 in rent. Her monthly mortgage bills rounded out to $8,500. After paying the water bill, Sharina, who owned 36 inner-city units, all filled with tenants around or below the poverty line, figured she netted roughly $10,000 a month, more than what Arlene, Lamar, and many of her other tenants took home in a year. As Sharina liked to put it, "The hood is good. There's a lot of money there." Quentin pulled the truck onto a dark and deserted street. There was one more stop to make. Terry, on Cherry Street. This was Sharina's most far-flung property, located on the west side of Milwaukee, near Washington Park, and a 15-minute walk to the colossal Miller Brewery. Sharina pounded on Terry's door, loud the first time, and even louder the second. The porch light flicked on and shone down on Sharina. She was in the fur-lined coach boots with matching purse she had bought in Jamaica. "Who's that?" a gruff voice barked. "It's the landlord." "Oh," the voice said, resigned. "That's right," Sharina whispered to herself as the locks came undone. Inside, the house was warm and smelled of dinner fried in grease. A single, small lamp was on, stingy with its light and leaving parts of the room veiled in shadow. Sharina found Terry in the company of some elderly kin and older children. Terry was a plump and pretty woman, with dark skin, long braids, and an empty stare. She was mentally slow and received SSI for her condition. Her boyfriend, who had answered the door, Antoine, a bony man with slicked back hair, leaned against the wall, just beyond the edge of the light.
What's going on?"
Sharina asked Terry.
"I ain't got any money with me and..."
Terry's voice trailed off. Sharina leaned over Terry with her hands on her hips.
"Terry,"
she began, using her stern teacher voice.
"I know.
Just give me the money. I'll give you a receipt." A moment passed. Then Terry said,
"All right,"
and reached into her pocket. Seeing this, several of the older children left the room. Sharina accepted a thick roll of cash.
"Who did your hair?"
she asked, reaching out and spinning one of Terry's braids.
"You like her hair, Antoine?"
Antoine was bringing a cigarette to his mouth. The lighter's flame momentarily brought his face out of the darkness. It was a face creased with humiliation. Lifting herself into the Suburban, Sharina said to Quentin,
"We got $1,400. Why, I can't get rid of her."
Terry rented a four-bedroom apartment for $725 a month,
She still owed $350 plus a late fee, but said she'd have the rest of the money tomorrow.
Well, all right.
Quentin congratulated his wife. Sharina felt accomplished, if unsurprised,